good evening and good screaming. I am Jello Biafra, and this is Renegade Roundtable. Many years ago, I was up in Seattle with a couple friends, Vic Bondi and Chris Novoselic, once in Nirvana, and they're both saying, yeah, we need to go see Gino tonight. Let's go see Gino. Who's Gino? And they explained it was a recent migrant refugee from Bosnia who was the pretty prominent musician there, but had to flee because of all the violence, a lot of it courtesy of a guy named Milosevic, and had wound up in Seattle and was playing in a little boathouse or something down by the water on a dock. So we go down, and it's slightly electrified and very danceable Balkan folk music, slightly gone electric and quite fun, and great conversation with Gino, instantly establishing himself as one of those characters people I like me should know and mount them on the virtual gallery of my weird friends. And then the next thing I hear from him, the band is now called Culture Shock, K-U-L-C-H-U-R-S-H-O-K, not to be confused with Dick Lucas's Culture Shock, spelled the King's English way, and it was a much, much, much more powerful beat. You know, definitely what some people might call gypsy punk, but in a different way than Gogol Bordello, maybe more guitar heavy, actually, and a little closer to one time Alternative Tentacles recording band with other refugees from unspeakable police harassment and the rest from the communist government in Czechoslovakia way back when. Anyway, without further ado, as Culture Shock just took off and even went back to the home country and blew everybody's mind many times, here is the one and only Gino Yebjevich.
What's up, Jello? How you doing? You forgot to tell people, actually, that you are the one who introduced us to Billy, who later on introduced us to the record label that later on made us travel the world, and here we are 26 years ago, so...
And then here we are back again, and new 7-inch and an album and then a newer one. Now, finally, after all these years on Alternative Tentacles, welcome and welcome to the show. But going back even further than that, what created you?
What created me? I don't know. I usually don't. I don't believe in creators. I mean, I would rather say that I'm stupid and not educated enough to know who really the creator is. I mean, I know my mom. I don't know my father. I know who he is. He died when I was 9 months. I shouldn't be this ambiguous. My. But out of the old creators, I kind of turn to my mom mostly. Like you to yours, right? They're approximately the same age.
Did you have a stepfather?
No, amazingly so. She was you can say whatever you want about socialism, but women over there had rights, not just rights, they had power. My mom was a judge and the president of the court and the Supreme Court justice. And at the end of her career, she was the head of the Supreme Court, like Roberts is today, right? So, and she retired at the age of 60, exactly how old I am, right? Now, because the war was coming in and she didn't want to dirty her hands. No guy in my life. And I actually, I'm even asking her to this day, like, hey, mom, really? I mean, really? Nobody? She's like, I don't want to talk about that. Nobody. she's a tough cookie.
Yeah, I don't know whether in Mother Russia or the original, Warsaw Pact countries or the evil empire, as we got programmed to call it over here, what so-called adultery or single parents, how they were even treated. And you grew up under communist rule, didn't you?
Yeah, but you know, our communism was different than theirs. We were not under the Warsaw Pact. We were different. We were in 1948, Tito actually gave a middle finger to Stalin and said, fuck you, man. I mean, I'm not going to be. So basically, since then, we were in the middle of East and West. It was very liberal communism, if I may say that. We were free to go anywhere we wanted. Nobody wanted, because we had pretty much social medicine, social, living and everything else you could do private. We did have a maximum wage, which I think would be a great idea today for many countries.
I got that from the platform of the California Green Party.
I know you did. I remember that. Yes, maximum wage is the way to go. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, I was once on that old Bill Maher show, politically incorrect, I believe was the name. And debating a maximum wage was one of the topics of the evening to justify having me on that show. And he just could not contain his shock and disgust that anybody would even advocate for such a thing.
Yeah, man. In a second, I thought that he might be he's a smart guy, definitely, but he might be on our side. But then very soon I figure out, he's the elite. Yeah.
Well, it depends on the issue. I mean, he struck me as kind of liberal libertarian, if you will. And like all great comedians that are political, sometimes he'll have one sentence that says as much as 10 zillion pundit columns.
Right.
News things. For example, either right before, right after George W. Bush stole another election in 2004, he said Republicans will do anything to win elections except get the most votes. And that's it in a fucking nutshell.
They haven't done it since Reagan, right? Who was the last person? Bush, that he had more votes than the Democrats. They haven't done it since ever.
You mean who actually did have Republic, more votes?
Actually, Bush, second time Bush did.
The claim is, but Greg Palast, who's been on Renegade Roundtable, who exposed how W stole Florida with the help of his brother Jeb and Secretary of State Catherine Harris, going after black people where suddenly they had felony convictions, even if they were in the future. Vote in 2000, you were convicted of a felony in 2004. Still doing that to people down there, according to Palast. It's that thick and wicked and all. And he thought that both Florida and Ohio, which has also been independently corroborated by a muckraker there named Bob Fitzrakis, that 2004 was stolen as well. And of course, we know all about the one Trump, and Palast made a movie of his one-time book about W called Best Democracy Money Can Buy, predicting exactly what happened.
I wouldn't be surprised at all, because I don't think there's a mathematical probability for them to win popular vote anymore. I mean, I don't think there is, right? How can they win the
popular vote? Well, if they can somehow get the public to embrace Ron DeSantis or worse and think cool, like they did with Reagan
if they win once again, we're screwed. I've seen that. I've seen you guys have no idea when it starts, you know, and you have no idea when it's already in, you know, when the fascists, they don't leave.
We're going to get to that in a second, but I want to go back a little more to the creation of Gino Yevgevich. You're growing up in a communist system with presumably quite the propagandized education. It might even be worth going into a little bit who Josip Broz Tito was, because he's completely forgotten.
Yeah, he is. I have to say, you know, dictators are very, very different animals than anybody else. And everybody is pretty much, people are very confused about whole dictatorship mantra, because they're not all equal and they're all not all same. One thing that is very significant and mutual for all the dictators, they all come from the people. They all come from the situation that it's really fucked up, and then they use everything and get on the, you know, there are different dictators out there. There's Adolf Hitler, but there's also Tito. And there's, you know, there is Stalin, but there's also Guy Julius Caesar. Not all of them did all the worst for their people. I have to say, till this day, I mean, my opinion aside, because dictator is a dictator, I can't really be, you know, on a dictator's side, but Tito is still beloved by the majority of the Yugoslavian people worldwide, in Yugoslavia too. People are still wearing his... Yes, I have to tell you. You go to Sarajevo, which is kind of a different country right now. You go to Zagreb, you go to Belgrade, and there's going to be a bunch of stores with the t-shirts with his image. And
I have not been to Sarajevo, but I have been to Zagreb, and I've been to Belgrade as well as Ljubljana, all part of the former Yugoslavia, and I have neither seen anything like this in any stores, nor has a single person I met or talked to ever had a good word to say about
Tito.
Is he
He's Serbian or Croatian or something else?
He was Croatian. But, you know, just the fact that the nationalist Serbs and nationalist Croatians do not like him both says that he did some things right. You know, what he did, really, I really don't want to justify all the political imprisonment and everything else. But I do want to say that the nationalism as the sickness of our people was suppressed. Is it good to suppress something? I don't know, but if that something gets out of the jail and then 3 million people die in the war, I would say that maybe right people were in jail. I mean, I would have never signed off the system that put any kind of a political prisoners. But with Tito, I can assure you that a lot of people still till this day have a positive opinion about him. I was pretty young when he died. I was 18. But I can tell you right now that nothing after, it was very progressive country at the time. You know, the infrastructure was great. Right now, not so much. Maybe Croatia is getting a little better because of the European Union helping and Slovenia. But it's a pretty complex story altogether. And, you know, the fact is that both fascist regimes, all the fascist regimes in Serbia, in Croatia, in Bosnia too, do not like him, but most of the people do. I, of course, I'm indifferent to the dictators. I'm just objectively looking at the picture how it is.
I mean, his reputation over here was as a less repressive communist dictator, but still a communist dictator. And the one guy who somehow magically united all these countries where people had been, you know, shooting each other in large numbers and killing each other in wars century after century. And somehow he prevented that. But I think even you're saying, yeah, part of the way he did that was through repression, where you are going to all be in the same country. But does this mean there was free and voluntary travel, even under Tito, between Bosnia and Croatia, or even Croatia and what is now once again Serbia?
Not just free and voluntary. We were marrying each other. Most of us are in a mixed marriages. It actually promoted, that is a good side of it. It promoted brotherhood and unity, how we called it, and really nationalism stopped with its existence. And today we can see that I thought for a while that organized religion is the biggest evil of the world. Now, when I see the Pope being actually a good guy, I'm thinking nationalism is actually, the most Catholic countries in the world, like Croatia, like Poland, actually hate Pope because he's a good guy. It's amazing. I'm talking about their government, not about the people. You know, which is amazing. Once in a lifetime, you have a Pope as a good guy, and now you hate him.
Yeah, he is in some ways, and typical Pope in other ways.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know what? I'm going to get the progress wherever you give it. And he's definitely a progress there. So, you know, back to this. No, not just that we're traveled between each other all the time. And I mean, I was a musician. I was a recording artist there. I played every single weekend somewhere else. It's not just that. We had a passport that was widely recognized everywhere. I was in the United States when I was 14 years old, and my passport did not need a visa for United States, and we could have gone anywhere we wanted. We could have worked somewhere and come back too. So there was no repression, like you can't leave. There is no, and everybody could come too. So there was a lot of miscommunication, actually misinformation. I remember when I was here in Fort Collins, Colorado. We were neighbors at the time, you and I. I was there, and I remember Ford and what's his name? Carter were battling. It's the first time in my life. And I was there just for the ninth grade of junior high school. And 1976, right? And I remember when Ford said that Yugoslavia is not in an Eastern Bloc and lost the elections for that. And he was actually right. I mean, I was happy he lost the elections because I always liked left in my life. But that was not a wrong statement, right? He also said that Romania wasn't the Romania was. But oh no.
God, that's a little more blatant.
That's Hobbes, yeah.
Confused about the nature of the East Germany. Ceausescu,
yeah.
Among other things.
Yeah, but definitely the information about Yugoslavia, what it was, first of all, most of the people here don't even, not just that they think that was a part of the Eastern Bloc, but they also think that it was a part of the Soviet Union. And, you know, education-wise, as you mentioned, I can say that we had a pretty independent education worldwide in a way that we started with history-wise. I'm thinking we started with the antique history, with Egypt Egyptian mythology, Greek mythology, how it relates to Roman mythology, and that actually developed my interest in the history and pretty much the world history as it is. Of course, from the socialist and the communist view that is the right system and the capitalism is dying as it is. But it was, can you say that it's not dying? That's a whole nother story. But it wasn't the whole the way free society, but it was good while it lasted and people loved each other unlike today.
Including people who identified Christian or Orthodox, or in the case of Bosnia, there was a significant Muslim population.
Still is, yeah. Right? Yeah. We had in Bosnia before the war, we had 40% Muslim population, 33% of Orthodox Christians, and about 19% of Catholics. The rest of them were, undeclared. I'm one of these undeclared. I never wanted to declare because I'm an atheist, but I also viewed, and I'm not really defending the system before, and definitely not the absolutist system, but I defend the idea where you love your neighbor. I defend the idea where you don't shoot at your neighbor. I defend the idea that freedom doesn't mean you take a gun and then you shoot whoever doesn't have the name that associates you at your name, you know?
Yeah. But if Tito had decided to embrace the West all the way and say we're not a communist country anymore, would the entire Yugoslavia have been treated to the same kind of invasion from Mother Russia, Mother Soviet Union that happened in Prague and happened in Hungary in 1956? Would it have happened in Yugoslavia too if Tito had gotten too quote unquote liberal or
did? I think it would not. He did actually. He in 1948 he stood up and he told Stalin, "You cannot come in." The thing is that we liberated ourselves. Red Army did not liberate Yugoslavia. Tito's partisans liberated themselves, and they also liberated the North Italy too. So basically, the NATO what later became NATO said, "Okay, fine, we will defend you from the Russians, but you please leave Italy." So they left Italy. and stayed in their way of the self-governing socialism, as that was, and my free translation. However, your question is so smart, and I was always asking myself, why didn't he go all the way into the democracy? And I can tell you, and I never knew that. I thought about that when I was like in former Yugoslavia, and like, you know, when he died, before he died, and this is my answer. After the war, I saw what happened, and something tells me that he was very connected with everybody on the West as well as on the East at the beginning, but more on the West, knowing that they would jump for him, but if he would let a plural party system in this country, that parties would divide on the national parties like they did when he died. Exactly that thing happened. National parties, and basically with us, with our country right now, with Bosnia, with Serbia, with Croatia, especially with Bosnia, because you have Serbs, Croats, Bosniaks who are Muslims and Jewish people, you know, especially there. There is no politics. There is no political parties. The political parties and the political system is leading to census. Everybody's voting for theirs because national parties are totally 100% diametrically opposite of the idea of the politics, because idea of the politics considers that you have a plan, economic, infrastructure, culture, and so on. No, you have only the national program that is giving you a cushion that they're going to fight for you against the other nationalists, which basically is evoking fear in people and making the elections pretty much a census. And that's what it is now. That's what it is now. And that's why I think Tito actually did not go that way. But economically he did, politically he did, knowing that that might evoke another war.
Did he die before the Soviet Union fell or after?
Before 1980.
Oh my.
1980.
Okay, so there was another strong man after him, at least one, before the whole thing became independent and split into all these countries.
Yeah, his name was. He was also Croatian. His name was Ante Marković. and he took the dinar and made it convertible and made it worthwhile. And I remember I was a recording artist, and this was my third record, I guess. And every single time I do the record, inflation was killing it, right? I do the record, I come to see the quarterly, it's this much money. You see, I mean, I sold 100,000 records of my second record, and I came in, and it was funny. I couldn't even take people for dinner for that money. All of a sudden, I'm coming, you know, to pick up the money, and there's money there. What happened? This guy actually made the dinar valuable. Now, that wasn't good for the nationalists. He was Croatian, so the Croatians actually just stabbed him in the back. Serbs hardly waited, hit him in the face, and then they made what they made.
Right. I guess we should go to this part now before this, which I want to look into too, personally, you know, what created you thing. But when we met and you were, typically brilliant, just this full of positive vim and vigor, even though you had fled for your life out of Bosnia when the war started, and then proudly
after the war. I came after the war.
You proudly proclaimed to me, I am the Peter Gabriel of Bosnia. That's what you said to me. And I'm assuming this meant Bosnia, but not also Croatia and Serbia or Slovenia or Montenegro, or were you a Yugoslavia-wide pop star at that point?
Yeah, I was doing pop music. I was doing pop music, and that Peter Gabriel thing was not about his music. It was about, basically, I was playing pop music before, and now I decided to do the ethno just because I was missing my own home. And yeah, after the war, I moved over here. I created a musical hair during the war in Sarajevo, and then Phil Alden Robinson, the director of Field of Dreams, and John Baez actually helped me come over here, and that's how I met a lot of people who wrote another theater play that played in Seattle. Ruby Marchand of Warner Music International gave me Jack and Dino's number, met Chris Novoselic, met you, life went on.
Exactly, but we gotta delve back into life before it went on here, because were you a solo artist, or was it a different band?
The name of the band was Gino Banana. And just another day, I acquired a couple of the records. I have them over here with me, if you want to see them.
Right here. Wave them at me if you can reach them. I'll be able to.
I can. Hold on.
Oh, no. We'll do it later.
Oh,
we'll do it
okay. Later. Okay.
Yeah, that's fine. But
they're right here.
Yeah, vinyl junkie librarian kid completest me someday wants to get those records.
Yeah.
But will I run fleeing from the room, like, because it sounds like Elton John, or is it going to have some of the Gino and the culture shock we know today in the music?
You will run away from the room because it's going to sound like Elton John. It's going to more sound like, well, the movie, the film that we were doing, it is about the changes, and it's about what happened in the war. I'm a war profiter. I'm not Peter Gabriel. I figured out I'm not Peter Gabriel. I'm a war profiter. I realize, and this is serious, I realized that I can die in any second, and I didn't do what I like. And since then, I started doing hair. It was a death metal version of the musical hair. And you have to hear that. That you would like. And then I realized that, you know, I am going to sing every single song like it's my last song, do everything that I do like it's my last thing in my life. That's later on, I started like helping people with developmental disabilities, because their personification, embodiment of that, sing every song like your last song. And I really never looked back. I never looked up. I have to tell you, you know, to be old and wise, you must first be young and stupid. I had this curse that I made it when I was really young as a drummer of the Promising Band when I was 16. Then I met all of these people. Then I made one hit, other hit. You know, you like those things when you're young. And then when the war happened,
Gino Banana, you are the singer for Gino Banana.
Yes.
Not just the drummer. If you were
No. I left drumming when I was, 19 years old. Then I became a singer. But I started really early and met a lot of people from the industry really early. And then it made me really early a pop musician. I had to run away from, it's not just, war made me realize that life is too short to waste it on anything that you don't like. And I really did not like that. I was 30 years old already at 28. I hated what I was doing, but it was a job. And, you know, and it was a very well-paid job. I was selling records like crazy. It's just like, it was, you know, not something that you leave, especially if you, in the 80s, in your 20s, right? But the war came in I'm telling you, I'm a war profiter because in that moment, I couldn't be what I was, so I can become something else. So I ran to the end of the world, to the end of the West over here, to run away from myself.
Right. You live you in know, Seattle.
To run away from myself and to do what I like. I was ready. I was pretty well financially at the time because Tito allow us to earn the money, you know, while doing music. But I lost everything in 24 hours because of the war, right? Slovenia, another democratic country, took all the money that we had. Just took it in their bank. The bank is ours, sorry. Money's
How
ours.
How did they manage to do that?
Because they're darlings of the European Union. I don't know what to tell you. I never got my money. I mean, you know, they said that they returned it. I never got it. Fuck the money. Doesn't matter. I have never been so liberated in my entire life. I remember I thought I'm going to die. Like, oh, shit, I don't have anything. And then in the morning, I woke up and thinking, I'm alive. My mom's alive. Girlfriend at the time was alive. My dog is alive. What the fuck do you want, man? People dead around you, you know? And it gave holy shit another light to my life. Absolutely. Since then, I was never the same. Absolutely. I'm just pissed off that I didn't spend it all. I don't regret it.
Oh, you spent it all there. Surely not a Yugo car.
Well, you know, better car than the tank.
Yeah, I also heard that the ones there were much better than the ones for America or vice versa. I can't remember. I mean, there's a book about them over here called The Worst Car Ever Made.
You know, you got to have the most, like this extremes, like the worst car ever made, the worst movie ever seen. I never knew what's my worst movie. I know the movies that I like, right? But did you ever think about the worst movie? Until I went on the plane, you can see the worst movies ever.
Yeah.
On the plane, I was watching Rupert Everett and Madonna. She's a yoga teacher and he is her gay friend. And then they have a child. Oh my God. I don't know. I can't. But I was with Roderick Romero from Sky Christ Mary on the plane. And I'm like, please, dude, you got to watch this movie. You got to see. I mean, there is some kind of a certain art in the bad movies. You know, this guy, if that's something bad, you got to see it. So yeah, maybe Hugo is maybe in that category. I never drove one though.
No, I have a couple of rock bottom movies and a lot of people would not agree with them either. But I thought the two worst movies I can think of that I've ever seen are Leaving Las Vegas and Chariot Fire.
I've never seen any of those. Leaving Las Vegas, I've heard.
Yeah, I mean, they're both highly regarded by some people, but not by me.
Oh, I wonder.
Oh, yeah. But, okay, so you lost everything overnight. It sounds like it was in the middle of the war, but
the beginning of the war.
Tell us how the war began and how it felt as an individual on the street living there and the signs you saw. And you say first it was the Nationalist Party and stuff, but somehow it blew up into the worst thing to happen to Europe until Putin invaded Ukraine and stuff. But unlike even Eugene Hood, who was just on Renegade Roundtable, who sends you a great big Eugene-sized hello. Yeah, there you go.
Brother.
He has not been caught in the middle of that war. Gogol Bordello has been in and out and played in places where it was safe to play. You were caught in the... You have actually been in a war, and not that many people I know or anybody listening to this know has ever really been in a situation like that, where it isn't just going over to Vietnam or getting sent to Korea like my father or Tim Armstrong, Rance's father apparently was. You were surrounded.
And
probably living in an apartment building, right? So did different people in the apartment building join different sides, and what made them do it, and how do they get all the guns and stuff? And it's kind of a step-by-step thing to rewind here as to how the first, you know, the rumblings of it and the winds of war, and then
How long do we have?
We have as long as we want.
Okay, it's
because you've talked to me about this a lot before, and it was fascinating. And so the entire Geno story that you've told Anne Marie and me and probably Vic and Chris, so many other people. Although another thing I remember from that first time in Seattle, you looked around and said, "Look, there's people from, there's Serbs here, there's Croats here, there's Bosnians here, and they all dance to me."
And I asked them on the show, like, "What the fuck is your problem, people? I mean, you're the best friends over there, you're hitting each other. What's going on?" This is how it happens. And, you know, it was always so mind-blowing to me when I was talking to you guys, to Americans, when they say, "Well, tell us how it is when you come back from the war, where you go into the war and then you come back from the war." I don't know. We don't go to the war. We just sit in our own place, minding our own business, and boom, like, war happens and shit happens. And I can tell you, humans are very durable animals. You have no idea what we can go through. And also, we are very good. We think that we're bad, but then you can see how people helping each other. And then you can always also see people joining different armies, people that you would never, ever think that they would, they do. And, you know, you would think, "Oh, this motherfucker, he is a right, you know, he's going to go with fascists." And he doesn't. And the guy that you would never think goes, you know. And I can't tell you that there are rules. My condo was on the front line in between, like, one day, one army, the other. So it was pretty much destroyed straightforward at the beginning of the war. So I went to my mom's right at the beginning of the war. That was right across the river. I mean, right there, very, very close, like less than 10 minutes walk. But this 10 minutes can be years in the wartime.
Yeah.
You know, and I spent time with her. I had a dog. How it starts, it's scary. It starts like it's not the war, and you don't know. We were in the war for a year before we admitted to ourselves that we are in the war. You know what I mean? It's like, it's one thing. We don't want to believe. We do not want to believe that we are. We want people to, you know, we want to somehow camouflage the fact. We are hoping that everything is going to be okay. So we're trying to convince ourselves that everything is going to be fine. No, dude, it's the war and it's going to last forever. So get ready. Being without electricity and running water is hard. Being without, you know, the media is hard. But it's not as hard as knowing that you cannot leave. At the beginning, I didn't want to leave. I didn't want to go. At the end, after that, you can't, even if you want to. But you have no idea that feeling when you realize you are really stuck over here and you're just a number in the negotiations. So it's mind-blowing how much we can survive and how much we can tolerate and how much we can consider normal. There were signs, now when I think about it, there were signs everywhere. They were doing people were doing paramilitary exercises in their backyards with the flags. What I can tell you right now is when you see the flag, run. Any flag, just run. Oh, you know? And that's the, you know, any nationalism, any flag, just run, because the shit's gonna hit the fan. Now, it's not all bad. And I can tell you one thing also, war profiter, what I realized, what I found out. We were all witnessing the expiration of the civilization. Civilization was vanishing before our eyes, little by little. One day this, the other day that, third day they burned the library, little by little, this friend, that friend. It's sooner or later we're all gonna die. It's pretty much like COVID. Sooner or later we're gonna get it. I remember when something dawned to me. I remember walking from my mom's flat to the theater where I was doing hair, thinking this is the other way around civilization, because civilization wasn't always full of competition and sick ambitions of the humans as it is today. Before the guy came out of his cave and circled the cave and said, this is my woman, this is my children, and you are my enemy, and I'm going to attack you, and when I win over you, I'm going to take your cave. Before the material wealth and aggression and competition kicked in, there was art. There was painting in the cave, you know? He was first painting, and then he figured out, let me fuck up the world, the human. When it's up, I'm watching the war. In the middle of the war dawns to me, I am witnessing the expiration of the civilization. And it's going to go the other way around. Because every single show, we had shows during the day because there was no electricity. Every single exhibit, every single painter, every single poet, every single musician were kicking ass. It's amazing. And people were coming out before the war, like after the war, like here, you couldn't pack the theater with guns, man. People don't go to the theater. People don't like art. People like what's served for them on TV, right? That was not a case. Art bloomed. Everything bloomed. And then I figured out the civilization is going back. You know, it is going back. It's going to come back to the paintings. Naively, I believe that after the war, if we stay alive, we can show the world how to live without money because we didn't have anything. Right? We still lived. Like, there's 3 years into the war. I'm still in Sarajevo. I still don't have shit, nothing, but we live greatly. I learned how to take the shower in this much of the water and then go, you know, do number one, number two, and shoot, flash it with that same water. You know, that's a skill to have. I could write a book about that. But the thing is, I really, really, really appreciate everything that I learned in the war. It's an experience that I don't want anybody to feel, anybody to ever experience after. I mean, that's not some. But I naively also believe that we're going to save the world, showing them that material doesn't matter and that material world as it is going to disappear because there is a proof. Sarajevo is the proof that we can do it without it. Can you imagine how stupid I felt after it? You know, I felt very stupid after it.
How did you get your food in this situation if you couldn't even go out and get larger amounts of water? How did you get the little small amounts of water?
There were open water hoses in the certain parts of town where there were lines and lines and lines in the water. My friend died. She died by wading, you know, and they were like, you know, the idiots were throwing, shelling the lines where people were standing in line for the water. Water would come once in a week. And then you would run and then you would collect everything you have, you know, every single dish you have, the bathtub, and that would be your water. You would boil your water, you would burn shoes, you would burn tires. They still do because they're poor. And, you know, that's how it is. That's a third world, second world, you know, the quality of air. When they start talking to me about quality of air, like, let's first feed people and then we'll think about that. It's hard when you come from those kind of that kind of life. It is hard for you to somehow go back into the civilization and not compare every single activity with the adequate equivalent of what's going on in the war. However, once again, I remember three months we didn't have anything. What was the food? Usually rice. That we didn't have anything. And then somebody would bring the soy sauce. Oh my God, that was gold. I remember at the time, the liter of oil was about $100. So the pack of cigarettes was like $20 or more. At the time, when the pack of cigarettes should be 50 cents, right? Even more than 20, $50. It was ridiculous. But that wasn't the worst thing. Again, the worst thing was that, you know, for instance, I went in the middle of the war, I got this accreditation and went to Italy and came back with soy sauce, but I came back. I you know, once you can get out, you get out and you see the world, but that's not your place. Your place is back home. What am I going to do in Italy? I remember 3 months we didn't eat anything. I was drinking oil to stay alive. And I'm not whining right now at all. It's not the worst thing that happened to me in my life. There are way worse things that I'm... When I was...
Right, drinking heating oil?
Yeah, drinking cooking oil. Yeah, that was the only thing that went up. Yeah, to stay alive, you know? And what can you do? Now, that's the reason I can't have French fries. But yeah, there's a lot of PTSDs. Like 4th of July, I'm never here. Like, gee, me and my dog, we're kind of the same. We run away during the 4th of July. We just go into the woods. But that's not the worst. The worst is still this, you know, this helplessness. You are a number in the negotiations. You are nothing. You are nobody. Like people in Ukraine right now. Like people in Iraq. I wrote this song, Mustafa, about only they know what I wrote about. I wrote about the, you know, shell going over your head. And it's not your mother that is going to cry because you heard it. The ones that you don't hear is the one that's going to get you. You know that, like, you don't know what to do with the person with a hole in their stomach. I do. I would know exactly what to do. I did it. You take off your shirt, you put it in and hold it until the ER comes. If they come, if not, then, you know, hope that he's not going to bleed to death. You know, but those were all, we are all adoptable animals. We can do it. We are capable of doing it. It's the longitude of all of that. It is it's the psychological indifference to the world. It's a sophisticated yourself. Sophisticated you that is suffering, saying, what the fuck? You know, at some point somewhere, I was thinking about terrorism in the world. And of course, I don't justify it. I would never justify it. But I remember one moment in my life, me and my friends sitting, talking about IRA, talking about, you know, we didn't have Al-Qaeda at that time. IRA and this buses that were blowing and things. Of course, I mean, when I see a fly, you can ask my wife, or a wasp or whatever, I catch it and I throw it out. I never would have killed a fly if I don't have. But you understand. You understand this cry on, look at me. Look at me. Look at me. I'm fucking dying. Nobody cares. You know, like in Ukraine right now. I'm sick and fucking tired of people saying, why is it? Is it because Russia has rights to this? Or the Ukrainians were like this? Or Russians were like, doesn't matter. People are dying. Stop fucking shooting. Who cares what it is? Just stop fucking shooting. That's the stuff that I understand that I don't think many people do if you're not there. The reason doesn't matter. There is no idea that it's worth one human finger, not life. Finger. There is nothing. There is not, like the kids that I'm playing right now for, they're 25 and older, and they ask me about, like, what can you tell us? I can't tell you anything. I can tell you only one thing. Don't listen to anybody, especially old farts like me who make wars. Sorry. I'm mad.
You recently said to me or somebody else that, you know, yes, there's war crimes, maybe even Ukrainian war crimes in addition to the Russian ones, but isn't war itself the ultimate war crime?
Yes, 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 it was. The war itself is the war crime. You know, terror is a war of... war is a terror of the rich man towards the poor man, and terror is a war of a poor man towards the rich man. That's how it is.
So it appears, depending on who's controlling the terror, too.
Who's controlling the weapons, too?
We're seeing attempts of that right now in Brazil, because Bolsonaro still hasn't conceded, and there's been hints he wants the army to help him with the January 6th. Mm-hmm. The nostalgist and whatnot, but they haven't done it so far. But that doesn't mean there aren't people starting all these fires, burning buses, truck blockades to try to get it started. And it was truck blockades in part that eventually brought down Salvador Allende, but who was behind the truck blockade? You know, in the case of Chile, a major force in that coup, if not the major force, was Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger, yes, CIA, yes, on behalf of people like ITT, who didn't want their copper mines nationalized, among others. It's not always the poor committing the terror if it's agents from somebody on the other side. That's what they, mercenary.
They don't call it terror then. You know, they don't call it terror. Of course, I mean, terror and the war are the same things. In my opinion, that's the same thing. However, if you remember, the legally elected Iranian leftist socialist president wanted to nationalize a couple of the oil, you know, oil findings over there. And then...
IBPs.
It was IBP. It was Iranian British Petroleum, right? And now it's BP. And if there wasn't, and then United States came in, took the guy down, put Shah Reza Pahlavi, then you had the Khomeini Islamic Revolution, and now you have Al-Qaeda and ISIS. None of that would happen if you guys, if United States wasn't fearful of socialism. Like, the guy was just elected. That was it. You know, the next elections was you know, none of that would happen. Nobody knows that. People don't know that.
We're talking about the coup in 1954 that overthrew the democratically elected either president or prime minister Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran. And installed the Shah,
who Reza Pahlavi, right?
Real monarch, who was a much more, you know, even physically much larger than the Shah we put in, who always, you know, had the inferiority complex. Dad, I'm going to show how much I can kick ass. And he was, of course, a very, very, very brutal dictator, much like the Saudi royal family or the Qatari or Bahraini royal family or even the Assad. No, maybe not as reckless as Assad, but, you know, there were even rock bands allowed for people who were, you know, had money and stuff in the Shah. But the Shah was so horrible that he eventually even lost the merchant class. And when he went down, Khomeini didn't get in right away, but it did turn into out with the old dictator, in with the new dictator. They were trying to do a democratic something or other. Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, who was briefly, I think, the head of the place or whatnot. And then the students seize the embassy and hold the American embassy and hold people hostage with the idea of doing it for the few days, prove a point, and then leaving. But Khomeini saw that as his chance to get rid of democracy too,
and
take over the place and make it a fundamentalist utopia. That
and that's what religious right do. That is exactly what religious right does. They're sitting there and they're waiting for their chance. The religious right, and you know, they will use everything. They use the, you know, Arabic Spring. Was Arab Spring was not at the beginning, was pretty, was civilized demonstrations against the, you know, for human rights. It was just hijacked by all of these, you know, all of these clerical, you know, religious right. And that right now, that's the same thing. It is, humans are very prone to believing conspiracy theories. Look at January 6th. I mean, all of that stuff. And the target audience is always less educated, the ones that are forgotten, the ones that they're, you know, that would like time machine, you know, that you can sell them time machine. If I get elected, right, I got a time machine. That's what it is. That's what Trump did. He sold them time machine.
With time that only looks like it sort of did on a few select television.
Yeah.
Okay, we got to take a quick little break here. The clock is striking 1 hour, and then we continue because there's much more to do. Hopefully you have time too. So
absolutely.
We will see everybody, hear everybody very shortly.